First of all, thank you for coming, and welcome you to the first of these seminars this year. It's particularly appropriate because our speaker, Francis Pinter, was the first speaker in our Arcadia series, so it's very nice to welcome you back, Francis. Thank you for coming. Those of you who remember her first presentation will know that she has a long and interesting history in this racket. Because she was for a time a very successful publisher, and then she worked with the George Soros organization, and then in recent years she set up and was the publisher of Bloomsbury Academic, which was a very interesting venture in publishing monographs, which are available in various forms, including under a Creative Commons license. And in recent times she's been very interested in a problem that has obsessed quite a lot of us in the Arcadia project and in the area of digital scholarship and digital publishing. And it seemed to me that the time had come to track what she has been doing in recent times in this area. So, Frances, thank you for coming, and the floor is yours.
Thank you.
Well, I'm really glad to be back here because it's been an exciting 3 years and lots of things have been happening in the world of publishing, e-publishing, and open access. And I'm going to talk about a problem, and then I'm going to tell you about my proposed solution. And I'll be talking about a new idea for a consortium that I think can square a circle, that can bring the price of monographs down and make them available in open access. Now, how many of you are librarians in here? Right. Is there any publisher in here? Ah, good. Right. Well, that's two of us. I expect to have the entity that I'm going to talk to you about up and running by next year. But as one American once said, good ideas are a dime a dozen. And it's really the implementation of a good idea that has to be done with razor-sharp precision, because it can go easily wrong just by getting the odd piece wrong in the execution. So I'm going to talk for a while, and then I'm going to, of course, entertain any questions you have and hope to answer them. But I have some questions of you. So I'm doing a bit of market research here. So I hope you'll bear with me. Now, the title is Open Access Publishing for Scholarly Books, and here the title is for Books and Library Consortia. I just want to be clear that I'm restricting my comments to humanities and social sciences because that's the area where there's still a demand for the long-form publication as opposed to the hard sciences where most of the academic publishing comes out in the form of journal publishing. So that's a kind of health warning there. Now, what are the objectives? Am I trying to achieve? What are we all trying to achieve? Well, there are five of them. One is to reduce costs to libraries, especially. The other is to recover costs. If a publisher is doing work on a manuscript, they have to pay people, and costs do need to be recovered. We would all love to have open access. How do we get there? We need sustainable funding, not the odd subsidy here and there, the odd grant, but a sustainable method of ensuring that the scholarly communications and these long-form publications continues for so long as the academic community wants them to. Not because publishers want them, not because libraries want them, but because it's an important form of communication, of research and thought. And we all want to maintain quality. So what are we looking at? We're looking at an expanded academic ecosystem. This doesn't seem likely in the UK, but you have to look at the world globally. More universities, more students, more academics, more research being done. So the ecosystem is growing. It's putting pressure on the academic community. Everybody has pressure on them to publish and to publish better stuff, to publish material with more impact. The REF we have here, the equivalents all over the place. However, at least in certain parts of the world, library budgets are shrinking. They may in some parts be static. There are a few places where it's growing. I've just been to India and they are growing, but that's more of a catch-up than anything else. And in this environment, there are huge pressures on academic publishers to publish more cost-effectively, bring prices down, and invest in technology. But we're not the only ones that are under pressure. Publishers, librarians too, are under huge pressure to invest in new technology. So what are we supposed to do about this? Well, we can blow a fuse and explode, and that's one response to the pressures. But what we really need to do is to have the stakeholders work together in a much more creative and holistic way. So we need the academics, the libraries, the publishers, and the funding bodies to all work together in order to come up with some really creative solutions. So what now? I just want to give a few headline ideas, and this is very much in the abstract, but it gives you an idea of where I'm coming from. What we really need to do, and we haven't done very effectively yet as we move into e-publications, is to avoid mirroring the print world in the digital realm. And we need to reduce the old gatekeeping function of publishers. Back in the times when it was the publisher who had to put in a major investment in order to produce a book, stock a book, ship a book, you could understand that they wanted to control the market. But this is no longer feasible, because if publishers don't adapt in this space, academics will just bypass them. And that'll be a pity, because all the studies show that the work of publishers, when it's done well, is valued. Somebody's nodding their head, but I can quote a few studies on this one. Design open access models that use the best of professional publishing services. Now, notice I did not say use the best of publishers, I said the best of publishing services. I don't think publishing necessarily has to remain residing with the old publishing structures and companies as we know them now, unless they adapt and do better. I think we have to experiment with new value chains and with new partnerships. And we should keep the best of past practices. Let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. So, what's to be done? Where do we look for sustainable solutions? Well, I work for a company called Bloomsbury. You may have heard of it. It's made an awful lot of money publishing Harry Potter. We now have offices in those cities, and since I made that slide, we just opened one in Delhi. And I was hired to start up Bloomsbury Academic. And they hadn't really done very much of academic publishing in a very serious sort of way before. But this is what they asked me to do, set up Bloomsbury Academic from scratch. So I said, okay, but I'd like to play with a new business model. Now I'm going to describe the open access business model that I introduced at Bloomsbury. But in order to describe it, I need a metaphor. And I'd like you to think about ice cream. John, look at the young lady.
I'm thinking about ice cream.
Right. So, think about plain vanilla ice cream. That's the metaphor for what we put on a Creative Commons license, which is basically the text of the book in HTML. It looks a bit like that. You can go to different chapters through there, but it's basically a long strip. And not everybody wants to read 300 pages of somebody's great thoughts in HTML. So, if you want then to please focus on an ice cream cone, because that's the metaphor for what we sell. We sell printed books, should you wish to have one. We sell ebooks off our site. We also sell through Kindle, through Sony, through Nook, through everybody imaginable. We sell through the aggregators. So whatever you happen to want in a format where you have a cone which carries the content, you can buy it. You have to buy it because there are costs associated with that. And now I'd ask you to think of a ice cream sundae. Think of chocolate sauce, vanilla sauce, fruit, nuts, sprinkles, all the different things that you can do with an ice cream sundae, tailoring it to your tastes or the tastes of the person making the sundae for you. And that's our enhanced ebook. Here's an example. This is called Open Space Learning. And it's, you can, that's the overview. You can press read and you can read it in HTML. You can go to additional resources. And we've got 35 additional resources. This is rather cool. 12 videos, then webcasts, podcasts, images, PowerPoints, whatever. Now, not every book has 35 extra bits and pieces, but that one tested our technology, I can tell you. At the moment, we're giving it away. We're giving away ice cream sundaes, but very soon it'll go behind the paywall. And what we're testing and have tested successfully is that the plain vanilla ice cream, because it's outside the paywall, markets the ice cream cone and the ice cream sundae, as it comes up in all the searches. So people are more aware of the book than if it were all behind a paywall. So that was the test. Will we sell at least as many as we thought we would, or less, or more, with this new model? Now, it's early days. We've only got about 50 of them out, but we had to sign up authors, and they take forever to write. And so it took a while to get these things published, and there's still a lot in the pipeline. But so far, the figures are looking very good. It does work. The business case is made. However, cost recovery still relies on selling the ice cream cones and the ice cream sundaes. I've got to sell enough print books and ebooks and whatever else I can sell, because I'm amortizing the fixed costs of everything that it costs the publishing company to get to the point where there's a digital file to put online across what I'm selling. So I thought to myself, well, you know, this is very nice for Bloomsbury Academic. We've got a nice business model. People like it. We're selling books. I haven't been thrown out yet. However, does this scale up? If every academic publisher followed this model, we'd still be where we are now. We'd still be dependent on individual units selling, and still rely on library expenditure to be the same per title as before, because the costs would all be inside each individual unit that we sold to libraries. So how do we square this particular circle? What is to be done now? Where do we look for a sustainable solution? Well, I started looking at the gold model from journals, which you're all familiar with, and I realized this wasn't going to work for humanities and social sciences, long-form publication, otherwise called the book. Why? Because getting to first copy cost, that's all the fixed cost to getting to a digital file, is just too high. It stands to reason. A journal article is this long, a book is this long, and science budgets, which is where the gold money comes from, tend to be this big, and humanities and social science budgets tend to be much, much smaller, and in many cases there is no budget because it's an academic sitting at home writing a book. So I went looking elsewhere. What about central university funds? Well, that was a very depressing little tour. Too many other demands, and too whimsical. Even if there's a little pot of money today to subsidize this, there won't be any tomorrow. This is no way to run a business. So I thought to myself, well, where are the funds that pay for monographs now? Where have they always been? And how can these funds be used more effectively? Well, the money that pays for these books that reside in libraries is, of course, in the libraries. Now, at this point, libraries groan. Groan. You're excellent. Because your funds are decreasing, and the amount of money you have for monographs is about that size in comparison to your whole budget. It's really very small and getting smaller. Now, before I actually propose the solution that I've cooked up, I'd like to go through a little bit of arithmetic with you, because you need to understand how we publishers come to price our books the way we do and where your money goes to. So this is the old publishing model, which is being replicated in E, more or less. Typical monograph. 400 copies sold to libraries. And I did this in dollars because I'm fundraising in America. $80 a book, say, £50. Well, 400 if you're lucky. If it's a specialist book, it may sell even less. And if it's not so specialist, it may sell a few more. But I just took this figure in order to illustrate a point. And the point is that $80 times 400, that's the $80 that it costs the library. The fixed copy costs, in other words, getting to that digital file, the organizing things like the peer review, paying for the design, doing the editing, getting the typesetting done, etc., etc., all of that, is about $10,000. You can quibble, it can be a little bit more, a little bit less, it depends on how long the book is, but it's a good number to work with. So of the $32,000, all the rest that you're paying goes historically to print and bind, to marketing and selling, and by the way, very little. The printing and binding is very little. But the marketing, the selling, the distribution, the royalties, the library suppliers who take a very large cut. I know you get a very good service from them. They make things shelf ready, but it's very, very expensive. $32,000 for that one book that gets into 400 wealthy libraries where there may or may not be an academic who's interested in reading it, but there certainly are academics in other parts of the world that can't afford to get to that book and won't get to that book on that old model. So just bearing in mind that the fixed costs are about a third of the price that you pay as a library, I want to propose approaching things slightly differently. And it's based on the following. Aggregate demand and aggregate budgets and have this all handled by what I'm provisionally calling a global library consortium, because I like the idea of it being international, that it spreads the pain and the joy. And the Global Library Consortium would pay the publisher that getting to fixed copy cost. In other words, the first $10,000. Now, let me run through the process of how this would work, and then I'll show you the financial benefits. The process would be that publishers would submit titles to the consortium in much the same way as they do now to library suppliers and to libraries. I mean, we send masses of brochures and catalogs in print, in e-format, all over the place. This metadata, advance information sheets, whatever, would all go into the consortium central office. The consortium would distribute this promotion material out to the libraries, the member libraries of this consortium. The next step would be that each library would use its own preferred method of selecting which of the titles they wanted to buy in on. So there'd be no compulsion, there's no big deal where you had to commit to a big package, not trying to mirror the journal model. But the member libraries would decide which books they want to buy into, and then send that order to the Global Library Consortium. And the consortium would aggregate those orders and place the order with the publisher, saying, right, this book and that book and the other book. We have a critical number of libraries that will buy into it. It's much like the Groupon model. And then that would trigger the publisher to get on with what they do and publish the book. And the Global Library Consortium would collect the money from the libraries and pay the publishers. Publishers at the same time would be able to sell in print and in ebooks and enhanced products. Think of ice cream cone, ice cream sundaes. But because the origination costs would be paid through this library consortium, the prices of the ice cream cone and the ice cream sundae can come down substantially, because you're not amortizing the origination costs into those individual purchases. So let's say that the 400 libraries that I was speaking of bought into this consortium and they paid the $10,000, the origination cost of a sample title, then that digital file would cost $25. But this scheme would be conditional on the publisher agreeing to making that book open access. And that's a really critical part of it. Be open access, free to anyone who has access to the internet. This is not about creating just a bigger library consortium, a closed consortium. And that would represent a two-thirds reduction in cost. But let's say that more libraries joined. Let's say 1,000 libraries joined. Well, the more libraries, dividing the $10,000 by the number of libraries, the lower the price per library. So if 1,000 joined, they'd only be paying $10. This is a huge reduction. So what would be the result? The fixed cost would be covered by a one-off payment, say $10,000, $15,000, whatever it is. There would be a reduction of costs to the individual libraries. Those that felt they had to have it in EPUB or had to have a print version could, of course, buy one. And there would be a secure income flow to publishers with vastly reduced risk, because I can tell you that two-thirds of the monographs that we publish end up being written off, at least. We don't sell enough of them, and that's why publishers are moving out of the monographs world. If it was a secure service operation rather than a risky investment proposition, publishers would look at it differently. Now, at this point, economists get into a real tizzy. They jump up and down in the room and they say, what about free riders? Free riders are the people who get the benefits of things they don't pay for and other people do. So what's the incentive of any library becoming a member of this consortium? Well, it's really easy to deal with that. Members get special discounts on the ice cream cone, the ice cream sundae, so that the free and the ice cream cone together are less than if they were buying a closed book. There can be other benefits too, benefits across a publisher's lists. So the easy way of dealing with the free riders, it's not a problem, not a hurdle. And how to run such an operation? Well, a small percentage, under 5%, probably 2 or 3% of such an operation would go to a central office that would run this. Now, I did a little bit of arithmetic and I thought, well, there are about 20, 25,000 monographs published in English in the world. And if only 1,000 came in on this, very modest expectations in the beginning, and they all paid $10,000 for each of these titles, that would be a throughput of $10 million. So the money to pay for the central office is also in the picture and doesn't rely on outside subsidies. So I'm going to sum up now some of the benefits, and then I have one question that I'd really like to ask, if possible, before you ask me questions. Okay? Is that allowed?
Yeah.
Okay, so benefits to the libraries. The simple way of purchasing content, you contribute to making this content available in a really streamlined way that has acknowledged how you like to buy, how you like to decide what you're buying. Your funds will go much, much further. I mean, imagine this up and running globally, 1,000 members, and the book you used to pay $80 for costs you $10. Hopefully use the same amount of money to buy more monographs. You may end up paying Elsevier more for their journals, but that, I hope, doesn't happen. And if libraries were to do this it would be the libraries who would be seen to be making a huge contribution to scholarly communications. You could have this, these books branded with your library's name and get all the kudos for opening up access. Well, what are the benefits to authors? Their books would still go via publishers and get the publishing expertise. Maybe that you as librarians decide to set up publishing units, but please get some people in who know about publishing. I would never dream of going into a library and trying to run a library. As an author, you'd get full open access, easy discoverability, and a metric for readership that at the moment you don't get. The benefit to readers: digital access to high quality research to anyone who has access to the internet. That would be branded, coming from sources that you can trust. Awareness of other formats and added resources. And the benefit to publishers: it's an opportunity to provide a paid-for service, which is a greatly reduced risk situation for publishers. And it will provide the content coming into the publishing house on which publishers can work to create added value and, where appropriate — it's not for every book, but where appropriate — actually create enhanced ebooks, enhanced products, which is what all the younger academics are asking of us. And that would be really exciting for publishers. But it requires one really big conceptual mind shift. It requires a lot of changing of attitudes about a whole bunch of things. But I think the key thing is to uncouple getting to first copy cost, getting that digital first file. Even first copy isn't right, because we all know that in digital there isn't a copy. But that whole business of just conceptually moving away from selling the one copy after another, and separating that out from all the other functions that a publisher carries out. And I think in this way, the money that is there, not extra money, but money which may reduce while we're still in hard times, may go up a bit again when things get better, but which is there, it would be a much better use of that money. That's the prize. Cost reduction, cost recovery within our ecosystem and not being dependent on whimsical money coming from elsewhere. Open access, sustainable funding, and quality publishing. And it's really very simple, just setting up this library consortium. Now, the question I want to ask you about is the name for it. But if there's somebody who really would like, you know, there's a pressing question about any of this that isn't understood, because I've gone through a lot of things quite quickly, I'm very happy to answer that first.
You want questions from us first?
Well, I was thinking about it after I said, do you feel happy about — I've got three possible names and I'd really like you to vote.
Yeah, let's do that first.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you want me to, and I'm going to talk about the names too, because when I first started thinking about this, I called it the International Library Coalition for Open Access Books. Now, what's wrong with this? Books. Well, A, it's too long, absolutely. The acronym is ILCOB. That doesn't sound very good. But can you imagine having anything called a coalition since we've had our new government? So it didn't stand the test of time. I gave this presentation at Harvard, and the Americans kind of went for this idea of the Global Library Consortium. This thing's going to be housed in Will Hutton's new think tank called the Big Innovation Center, and they don't like this. And I don't like it. They don't like it because it's too pretentious and very un-British to be so imperialistic. I mean, maybe that was Britain at some point, but it's more of America. You know, it just, I don't think you can call anything global anymore. And the kids, they like ice cream. That's exactly it. There are about 30 young researchers at the Big Innovation Center, and I listen to them saying things like, "I'm going to get my publisher to make ice cream sundae," and you know, "What kind of sprinkles have you got on your ice cream sundae?" And because I've been talking about the Bloomsbury academic model now in terms of ice cream, people write to me about ice cream, and I say, "Well, I can't call it ice cream. Librarians won't take me seriously. This is a serious thing. We're talking about scholarly academic research. You can't call it ice cream." And they say, "Well, what about Yahoo? What about Facebook? What about Google?" So I'm of, there have been lots of other suggestions. But they all fall into one of these three categories, terribly long and descriptive of exactly what it is or might be just today, but maybe not tomorrow. Short but pretentious. And ice cream.
So why don't you call it Ice Cream International Consortium, and then you've got
the ice cream International Consortium. Okay. Well, why don't we vote on the first three and then discuss what, because if nobody likes ice cream, we're not getting to Ice Cream International Consortium. How many think that of the three, and it's not that any of them is perfect or really great. You're not pledging to being really great. But how many think that number one is going down the right line, and which you would take more seriously? One. Number two, how many think this kind of approach is better? Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. Okay, how many go for ice cream? 1, 2, 3. Even the person who suggested ice cream consortium?
Yeah, all right.
All right, that's four at least. How many didn't vote? Oh, okay, so we have four abstentions. Okay, well, that's really helpful. That's very helpful. So, now
okay.
Open to questions.
Okay, questions. Can I kick off?
Yeah.
First of all, thank you very much for a very thought-provoking idea and a really nice presentation of it. It rings all kinds of bells for me, because I can see echoes of this in lots of what we've seen in the development of the digital ecosystem over two decades. For example, going back to the discussion about the name, and you mentioned, what about Yahoo?
Yeah.
What about Google? Yeah. And so on. Well, the answer is that in most of these cases, what about Amazon? What about Delicious? And all that kind of stuff. Okay. All of those wacky names, which have become global brands and verbs and so on, They have the distinction of being, all of them came from individual founders or co-founders of enterprises that were startups. And the problem that, and that's fine, but what you're trying to do is trying to, in the end, this idea requires a lot of established organizations to get together. And what we know about established organizations, at least what we know about universities, is they sooner die than do anything original. And so they won't, anything that smacks of that kind of stuff. For example, the latest release, John Norman will correct me if I'm wrong, the latest release of Android software is called Ice Cream Sandwich, is that right?
You try that
on the University Librarian. And I can tell you the look you get. So I think nice though it would be to have something like kind of a really radical, fresh name that appeals to the younger researchers and people you've been talking to. My hunch is that's not on. But it comes back to what I was coming back to. Really, was something different, because at each point in your presentation, I was thinking, what kind of conceptual shifts would this require from people in the system? And every time I thought of that, I thought, this is that's the hurdle that has to be overcome. And if you look back at the history of the digital, of the evolution of our digital ecosystem, for example, you find the record companies faced with on the one hand, a problem, and on the other hand, an opportunity, and then absolutely failing to address it.
Yeah.
Absolutely and totally failing. And in the end, the thing being addressed by somebody who had razor sharp execution, namely Apple. Okay, so that's an example of razor sharp execution. In relation to, say, thinking about publishers, you think about how newspapers, print publishers, got the internet more or less completely wrong, and as a result, they're probably doomed. But they got it wrong for cultural reasons. That they thought that what this was all about was the preservation of the printed paper in a digital ecosystem. And that's why there is a problem with books, I think, because, again, that's why the first title doesn't work, because you're right, books don't work as well. So my feeling about all of this is that your view that the thing that really matters is to have great execution. That's true, but it's actually the smaller problem. The bigger problem is the cultural changes that would be required in order to make something like this happen, even though it makes sense.
Can I answer that?
Yeah.
I thought the same until about 9 months ago. And I think what's happening in the publishing world, which is where the resistance might be strongest, is that publishers recognize that there's a crisis in the publishing of monographs in the social sciences and humanities. And really, most academic publishers don't want to see that side of the business just dry up, disappear completely, because they feel they're not serving the academic community properly. And I've had so many publishers say to me, we need a new business model. Yours might work. At the Frankfurt Book Fair, I took my nerves in my hand and then went off to see some of the directors and presidents of the leading academic publishing houses, and 9 out of 10 said, give it a go. The Harvard seminar that was organized by Bob Darnton, head of the Harvard Library, brought together in one workshop under one roof in January in Boston, when nobody really wants to go to Boston, 30 people who were from the publishing community, directors of the presses of Yale, MIT, Harvard, Princeton, Chicago, plus equivalent university librarians, plus the open access thought leaders, and we thrashed through the business model. And there were sort of small issues that came up about the execution. But the mood of the meeting at the end was, let's move to the next stage and do a pilot, which is, you know, as much as I could possibly have wanted out of such a gathering. Publishing is a pretty macho industry, and that's probably a problem because they don't like admitting that there is a problem. But it's gotten to be so bad with monographs that they know that, you know, if they're selling 200 copies of something that's £80 or £90, is this serving the needs of academia? And of course, you're in a very privileged situation here with your Cambridge Library, but even you are feeling the pinch, so I don't imagine the rest of the world. They're losing money, and the idea is that, I don't know whether this will make sense. In publishing, our shorthand for this is publishing is a markup business. So you take your fixed costs, and that's your production and royalty, and you multiply that by a number, and that's how you get your price. So with these monographs, it's anywhere 8 to 10 times the production cost. And then you sort of assume that when you sell a certain number of copies, you'll get to break even and then you'll make money because what it generates is enough money to cover the overheads that you've just got floating around in this system. But what people forget is that there is another way of doing this, that if it were more of a service operation, like a service company, you go in and you say, well, getting the digital file, getting it to first digital file costs X, and we're going to add on 10% profit, then you have within it the profitability that the shareholders want. And in an ideal world, and what I'm trying to get at as I'm working my way through these numbers, the digital file will stand as a product on its own, and a publishing company will be able to afford not selling any ice cream cones and not selling any ice cream sundaes. That is an extra revenue stream. The ice cream cone doesn't take any risk. The ice cream sundae may. But it's a decision to be made after the first digital file is up online open access.
Do you think libraries will be happy just getting the plain digital file as it were online?
Well,
this is
what I'm in discussion with people, and it's part of the questions that I'd like to ask you. I think this will change over time in any case, which is why the ice cream metaphor works, because the plain vanilla ice cream today is the HTML. It may be something else tomorrow, simply because expectations will change.
What do the researchers think?
About what?
About the model.
Oh, they love the model. They're really excited, and in general, I can tell you that when we started putting monographs on open access at Bloomsbury Academic, we got authors who were so excited, particularly established authors, because we were a new imprint. We had that against us as well. We were fighting against Cambridge University Press, Oxford University Press, and there we were, the new kids on the block. So we actually started, and it was a strategic thing to do, with older, more established academics. So we got some big names first, and then the younger people felt comfortable to follow. It kind of depends on what field, and again, this is changing, and classics is coming along a bit more slowly than the books on in media and digital communications. But the whole digital humanities area is just exploding, so I expect lots of monographs coming from there soon, too.
One of the issues I had with Global Library Consortium is that there is no existing kind of global model for department, which, you know, doesn't touch everyone, for libraries. But there are library consortia around talk to each other. Do you see any kind of role for them in getting initial take?
Absolutely. When I was working for the Soros Foundation, I developed the business model and set up EIFL, Electronic Information for Libraries. And this is a library consortium. I think it's still the world's largest, and it covers 50 countries and 2,500 libraries. Now, it's very specific to transition and developing countries. But absolutely. I mean, I'd love this to be... Maybe consortium isn't quite the right word. It's a membership organization, and consortia can become members just as easily as individual libraries. And that would certainly make my life easier.
You say what's in the name. You've kind of covered that by saying you started with established people.
Yeah.
So that seems to me like a great success.
Well, I'm talking to the most prestigious publishing companies in the world to get them on board first. Not all of their books, but even if I have a few samples, so that I signal to the rest of the world, these people are taking it seriously. And I'm talking to some of the best libraries in the world and getting them on board so that other people can see that this is a serious venture.
So the other group maybe that has an interest in seeing it go forward is the funder. Increasingly, it's a condition of research funding that the results of the research be published in open access. So
yes.
Do you see that publishing through this model as being a key acceptable?
I do. I think a lot of the pressure will come from funding bodies to find open access solutions. And if not this, come along with something better.
I think there's, just on that, I think there's less pressure in humanities and sort of science
sure.
publishing than that.
No.
The Research Council's UK have a draft open access mandate,
really?
The latest one in progress. And if that comes in, I should say I work for one of the scientific research councils of librarian and one of their institutes. And if that comes in, then it's going to be mandatory for all the hard sciences, 6 months, for arts, humanities and social is 12 months with a view to it all being the same coming down
yeah.
6 months.
So we'll
that is in process now. There was something about it in last week's Times Higher Education, Times Higher Education, page 67. Because I sort of had to send information to somebody. There's a sort of
okay.
stuff. So
yeah.
That's quite significant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a number. Well, what I think needs to be figured out is how one gets the shelf ready, the open access content shelf ready, for you.
One of the other things is you don't necessarily have UK PubMed Central. You know, there's one or two things where you have these subject-based things
yeah.
where people can put them in. But one of the problems is that in certain subject areas, so some of my colleagues who work in crop science, you know, where do they there.
Yeah.
And obviously with the arts.
Yeah.
John?
So I like the model in general, and I've got a question really about trying to untangle a part that I got confused on, and that this is the transfer of risk. And I wasn't sure whether you were talking of transfer of risk or elimination of risk.
It's more elimination of risk rather than transfer.
But I'm not sure that I...
Well, reduction of risk. It doesn't...
So reduction, certainly a reduction of risk on the publisher side, but potentially creating new risk. So the thing that I wasn't... What happens in the library scenario where there's a candidate publication and we go out and we do due diligence and decide we would want it, but only 150 libraries agree with us?
Right. Yeah. In that case, just like Groupon, it doesn't go ahead.
Right.
And it's...
So we've had a cost.
No, you don't buy it.
Well,
you,
there's a cost of our time.
You can buy it... Well, then the publisher publishes it closed, and you buy it at the closed price.
Okay. Patricia, sorry, you
were
up next.
Yeah, one thing that strikes me is that this is coming at a time when we're transferring some of that collection potentially down one level towards the users. So kind of patron-driven acquisition has suddenly become a buzzword, and you know, libraries are trying it out sometimes. And it does seem to me that this is the right moment for this, and at the moment you're talking about the libraries holding the funding and making decisions themselves. But it would be perfectly possible to transfer that kind of decision making down within this model.
Absolutely. And I expect
so
that to happen. Yeah, well, I expect what will happen is, okay, the library gets the information but sends it off to department heads or department person who is responsible for selecting books. I mean, obviously some libraries have acquisitions librarians, but some don't, and they devolve that decision-making to the departments in some way or another. So once the information gets to a key point in the library, how that's disseminated throughout the university and their system and how those decisions get taken, it can be anything.
What I was suggesting is that at some stage the library isn't necessarily going to come into that decision. There's an automated decision.
There can be, yes. Yes, it can be automated.
Or
yeah. It's certainly the tech will be set up so that it could be automated. Well, there'd have to be a budget holder somewhere that then sort of aggregates back up.
The point I was going to raise, actually, is the same as Patricia's about the possibility of bringing in something like PDA for this. But, of course, the PDA that comes with a lot of front-end administration on behalf of the library to set it
yeah.
up and to use a method for bringing it in and to make sure it runs the budget. And I'm a little bit concerned about how this is actually going to work in practice, where you have a potential for needing to get feedback from, say, 150 or 500 libraries within a pre-publication period that then sets a price that's then going to work for the library budgets.
Well, what I'm hoping will happen is, at least in the trial phases with a smaller number of libraries, is that we experiment with that and see if libraries might be prepared in the first instance to put a certain sum aside for this. A bit like PDA, you have to take a view as to how much money you're going to put into that each year.
But there might be a kind of sense in which it's easier for some of the bigger libraries just to say, okay, well, we'll take everything published by somebody else because that's likely to be useful for everything you're going to offer us.
Yeah.
Rather than it being done on a sort of time.
That's fine too. I mean, there'll just be a period of time in which you'd say, okay, I want all of this. Which is kind of like what used to sort of happen a long time ago with the library suppliers with their approval plans. Maybe we go back to something like that universities ask for a profile.
Can I just ask another question, which is, where will it be hosted? Are we talking about this be being available on the publisher's
Yeah.
server.
Let me ask you what you would prefer. Because, yeah, yeah?
I would imagine it would be better if it was on the publisher's server, but it was, then you're into issues of maintenance and access and possible confusion over license agreements with different publishers wanting to have different things. So would you be thinking of adding into the cost of having a kind of central platform of the material itself?
Yeah.
So it was searchable. So
yeah.
Rather than having a cross,
yeah.
You can have some kind of cross-publisher.
Yeah.
Search.
Yeah, I would like to see it on one platform. Publishers are of two minds, whether they wish to put it on a platform that's not theirs or whether they'd prefer to keep it on their own platform. But even if it's kept on the publisher platform, it would still need to meet certain criteria so that it would be pretty much the same and same conditions across the different publishers. Yeah, but we've got to move away from what's happening, where everything is now getting so detailed and granular that everybody's spending all their time looking at contracts. Somebody told me the other day that a terms and condition of some contract had more words than Hamlet in it. I mean, how? We've got to move on. I think everybody's got to. Agreed with that, yeah.
The thought that this conversation is brought into my mind is Kickstarter.
Yeah,
Yeah. And one of the twists you want on it is we as libraries might want to know how many of the people saying they wanted the publication were our academics and that might thank us for contributing. And from the publisher's point of view, it's how many of the offerings are from their stable of authors. Or
yeah, that's an interesting thing to add into it. Certainly user stats is something that we're looking at to see what added value we can produce and supply to publishers and to libraries on the user stats. I mean, there are studies that have shown on selective publications that have gone open access that the usage just skyrockets. Whether, how that plays out when more and more become open access, we'll see.
But the Kickstarter model suggests ways in which if you were going to implement you could semi-automate a lot of the decision making in the system.
Yeah. I mean, if libraries are happy with that kind of automated decision making, that's fine. What I wanted to do was get a sense of, and we'll be working on this with focus groups and so on, is get a sense of how much control the libraries want and how much are they prepared to just automate. But if a book is somewhere between $10 and $20, it's not a big decision. Yeah.
That generally tends to lead to trouble. Yeah. Okay, I'm looking at the time thinking about the university library's closing time and the fact that you need to have time to have a drink. So what I suggest we do is stop at this point and thank Francis for coming and for telling us.
Thank you.
If you haven't had a drink, it's fun.
Very, very good presentation in my view.
Thank you.